and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest is the poet Amanda Reynolds. After completing her degree at Allegheny College, Amanda Reynolds escaped the snow for beautiful Florida only to find out that life in the Sunshine State is not all palm trees and fruity drinks. During her MFA studies at the University of Florida and her PhD years at Florida State University, her poems were full of swamps, cockroaches, and dead armadillos. Now, she's back to Pittsburgh, the city she loves. She is the author of the chapbook Degrees of Separation on Pudding House Press and her new collection, Heinz 56, published in 2012 by Main Street Rag. Hi, Amanda.
Hello.
Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start us off with some poems?
Absolutely. The first poem that I'm going to read is The City of Pittsburgh Writes to Venice. Venice is sometimes considered one of the most beautiful cities in the world, mainly because of its rivers and its bridges. So I was thinking, what would Pittsburgh say to that? So this is The City of Pittsburgh Writes to Venice. I've got more bridges, you know, 446 on a good day, but who's counting? And yes, we are real Italians. Ask Jimmy and Nino Sinceri down at the Strip. The Stimulli brothers, De Lucas, and Penmac have enough cheese and sfogliatelle for everyone. Sure, you can brag all you want about canals, but try and show me 100-pound catfish sliced open with a man's boot inside. We've got those in our rivers, too. From what I hear, only flies love your little streams that smell worse than Philly cheesesteaks. I admit, Venezia sounds beautiful in Italian, but I'll cook your risotto for a year if you can pronounce Monongahela, Weirton, Yackageni, Duquesne, Versailles, Beltsuver, and Wilmerding without cracking up. Go ahead and try it. Yeah, we've got a regatta. With our boats, you don't even have to row. You're older, but is that really something to brag about? Napoleon, Attila, and the Crusades did so much for your reputation, wouldn't you say? You can even feed our pigeons without a license. Stephen Foster could play Vivaldi under the Campo, and we've got plenty of room to die while you're cramming bodies into San Michele, digging them up every 12 years to dump them in a boneyard. City of Light, did you say? Queen of the Adriatic? Serenissima? You're so proud of that printing press, but what else? Try our banana split. The first game of bingo was played here. The first emoticon typed, radio broadcasted, Ferris wheel conquered, and gas station built. For God's sakes, we made the first Big Mac. Sure, once or twice we've had floods, like back in 36 when the water rose 46 feet and sunk the streetcars. But in case you haven't heard, you're drowning. Send us a postcard, will you? We'd love to hear from the most beautiful city under the sea. This next poem is called What We Were Eating. It was written actually when I was living in Florida, and I had taken a trip back to Pittsburgh, and I had remembered all of the things that I missed about the city. So this is What We Were Eating. When we leave Florida to visit Pittsburgh and family for Christmas, it's all about Iron City beer and Permane Brothers. Grilled meat, chilled coleslaw, hot fried egg, tomato, French fries, and lettuce, all between slices of thick, chewy Italian bread. The same cook flipped the pastrami last year, and you tell me there isn't enough salt. Imagine my Nana running the numbers and peddling penny stocks to the neighbor women when things were slow and someone mentioned something great and depressing all at once. She'd leave Forbes Field with her second husband, or was it the third, when the Pirates beat the Dodgers and everyone feasted on warm baked beans, Klondikes, and skyscraper cones, a nickel each. George Crowhey wasn't yet the president of Chip Chopped Ham. You've never heard of chipped ham, like I don't know about Jimmy's or pork rolls. But I promise, if I had known, I'd never have eaten any of it. It's all tofu and granola for me now that I know there's pork lard in the Gibble's chips. For 59 cents a pound, my ancestors bought hog legs shaped like footballs, passed through a slow system of mechanized preparation. The fat and muscle trimmings collected and tumbled to separate the protein, the meat reshaped, the adding of seasoning, and the resulting flesh-colored pudding. The paper-lined can molded the meat into a loaf. After cooking for 5.5 hours, the result is 17% fat. That's just how things turn out. My grandmother learned from Isley's to cook an egg in the center of a meatloaf. And you should have been there the day she tried a pickle instead. Juice soaking into the cheddar and meat and everything covered in thick baked Heinz. But tonight, it's all about Primanti's on the strip and a hockey game. We'll have nachos later because the cameraman likes blondes, hat tricks, and nachos. I think there's something I've forgotten about this place. Maybe someone. Something about the last goalie to face a puck here without a mask. Something about the silverware the Primanti uncles didn't order for the dock workers in the middle of the night when they opened the doors to their restaurant, and how no one wanted to wait, so they piled it all onto the bread in layers hot and cold. Something about my grandma's pierogi recipe. But you've got my knee under your warm palm. There's a white frost outside, and Crosby's got the puck. All right, this next poem is called Baseball in the City, and it's actually about Pittsburgh's sort of illustrious and successful but sometimes overlooked African-American baseball leagues. So, Baseball in the City. No Pittsburgh Pirate ever hit a ball out of Yankee Stadium, but our Josh Gibson did. That home run king hit so hard in 32, the ball left Pittsburgh and landed in an outfielder's glove the next day in Philly. "You're out," yelled the ump. "You're out yesterday in Pittsburgh," I heard him shout. And whether I played the Homestead Grays or Greenlee's Crawford-colored Giants, it was sweet under the portable lights on Forbes Field in spring. 9 pennants. What team will ever top it? Every rich kid had a jersey, and every poor woman on the hill wore a smart hat for weekend games. They came to watch Vicious Vic throw those fists and Chet Brewer toe the rubber. When it was over, sure, I was happy to see Jackie take the mound, but I'd play it all away to see cool Papa Bell again, see him running, running like he stole something.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Amanda Reynolds, reading from her poetry collection, Heinz 56. Something that impresses me about these poems is the sort of swirling of details that are combined from sort of like contemporary experience and relationships and family and, you know, food, but then also worked in with the history of Pittsburgh and historical narrative. And I'm curious how you come across all of those details, like whether you do research, and how you choose to combine them into a poem.
That's a great question. I have done a ton of research on Pittsburgh. One of my favorite books is by Stephen Laurent, the Pittsburgh book. It's a huge collection. It has these wonderful images and all sorts of details and stories about Pittsburgh. So I definitely relied on a lot of his historical images. Also, a lot of my stories, a lot of my images come directly from stories that my family has told me. So stories from my grandfather, stories from my parents as well. But most of all, I wanted to sort of share those stories in my book and tell my own story as well. So I sort of set out with those two goals, and definitely the images of food and history and just contemporary Pittsburgh were the things I really wanted to focus on.
I'm curious about the decision to focus so much on Pittsburgh in your book. It says in your bio that you did your postgraduate work in Florida. And there's just such an emphasis on the city. And I think that that impulse to tell one's story and to sort of include historical narrative is something that the poets do. But you have a unique take on it and really focusing on Pittsburgh.
Yes, I wrote almost all of my poems while I was living in Florida. And I think I was missing Pittsburgh. I was missing family and food and everything about the city. So it just sort of naturally happened that I wrote mostly about Pittsburgh. I didn't necessarily set out to do so, but once I started writing those poems, I just kept finding more good stories, more interesting things. And also, I grew up actually about an hour east of the city. So to me, when I was young, Pittsburgh was this amazing place. It was this trip we only took on special occasions. Like for Christmas, we came to see the windows decorated, or we would come down and see where my grandfather directed the barges at J&L Steel. So to me, it was a very magical place, and I had never actually lived in the city until the past few years. So I imagined Pittsburgh even more than I lived it. And so I thought that would be great for adding into the poems.
That's an interesting point, the imagining and the living combined, because I think I'm thinking of the detail in the poem with the Permane sandwiches and like the sort of invention of the Permane sandwich and this really clear image of like the dock workers and there being no silverware and the sandwiches that are created there. And it seems like there a lot of imagination has to go into making those historical records sort of vivid.
Yes. And in fact, it has upset some of my family, in fact, when they've read the book, because I've had to invent what people said or exactly what happened. So it's very interesting trying to explain to people once in a while, well, you know, the basis of the story is true, but we don't know for sure, of course, what they said. We don't know exactly what happened. So there's definitely a lot of imagination that goes into it and a lot of creativity, which is difficult sometimes to explain to someone who hasn't necessarily had a background in poetry or read a lot of poetry.
Yeah, there's a lot of family in your work. Is that something that you think about when you're writing, that response of theirs?
Yes, absolutely. I stop myself constantly from writing certain things, or I change names, or, I mean, most of the stories are positive, so, there's nothing really to be worried about. But there are definitely times and things that I leave out of the poems for that reason, absolutely.
Wow. Can you read us some more poems?
Sure. This next poem is called The Banana Explosion of 1936, and everyone seems to like the title of this poem, so I wanted to share it. If you've been to the Strip District lately, you've probably seen the big church down there, which is St. Stanislaus. And the next time you visit, make sure you look next to the church, because you will still see an abandoned building. It's a warehouse that used to house bananas. And at one point, there were so many bananas in the warehouse that the gas had built up and caused a huge explosion, and it actually damaged the church. So this poem is about that. The Banana Explosion of 1936. No one believed at first that bananas could bend the domes of Stanislaus, God's work. Yet for a block, the glass crashed into the streets. There was nothing left to do but drink. The drinkingest town in the West had a pub on every street. Long days spent at Agnew and Brown's Pigeon Ball Factory earned a small pay. And at James Jelly's Cotton Factory, they knew that a draft from a Bakewell's glass was the way to cut grime from the throat. Prohibition wetted these streets where booze barons worked as celebrities, and whiskey came at $16 a quart. The first club, the Devil's Cave, sold bourbon in a heavy glass, raised to FDR, the first Democrat a city like ours could support. Work in the mills went on as long as there was beer. Lights, coal fires, and pitch pots burned as strong at noon as in the night. But for every drink, they bent a knee under the new stained glass of St. Stanislaus. Even when there was no work. These laws came to the city first. The gas explosion in the ripening room twisted towers beyond what work, faith could repair. So with glass and steel, they rebuilt with pious hearts and drank. A few years ago, I was lucky enough to be at the groundbreaking for the new Kunsal Energy Center. I actually skipped work like so many other people did to come down and listen to Mario Lemieux and listen to everyone introduce the new arena. But it was also a very sad time because it meant that the igloo was being torn down. And being there that day made me think of all those good times that I had had in the igloo. And it was a very important part of me growing up in Pittsburgh. So I wanted to read my poem called Tearing Down the Igloo. It's named Mellon Arena now, but only broadcasters have to call it that. Resting on an icy hill, the inverted silver bowl with a retractable dome has globed the city's hockey team since 1967. It's summer, 41 years later now, and at the groundbreaking for a new arena, I'm breathing 2 feet away from Mario Lemieux. As godlike as ever, he adjusts his shades and signs a few photos as he glides through. I've skipped out on work, like so many others, to listen to Jeff Jimerson sing the anthem and see the mayor toss up a shovel of dirt while, let's go Pens, echoes off bulldozers and nearby buildings. At my first game, Dad's friend Howie made me listen to the radio broadcast on my Walkman. He said I wouldn't understand, but from the puck drop, I did. When Yager tucked in his shirt and skated off, mullet flying in the wind, I was addicted. I waited for hours for Marty Straka, who signed my jersey upside down, chatted up Reggett in his alligator loafers, and booed the Flyers loud. I saved Mario trading cards and bun candy bars and tried to skip school for the victory parade. Mom remembers when games were cheap and the team rarely won, but they sure could fight. Back then, the arena had a real penguin, Pete, who appeared before the games. He died after only months, but his replacement, Repeat, skated on. We all know Lang and the old 2-9er get drunk when there's no game. Airy's funnier when he's between the benches. And Malkin has to hit the trainer with the puck on his way off the ice. Jeff Reed sat in Section C. Big Ben hangs out in Lemieux's box. And every day's a great day for hockey here. You should duck when the cotton candy man goes by and boo louder when Hossa comes to town. A Kasparaitis jersey is still a safe bet for now. Save me a seat in that new arena, please, though I can't promise I'll love it quite as much. At least Briere and number 66 will still have banners in the eaves, and the organ will echo from above. Half the reason I came back is hockey, maybe more. I thought I should read the poem that my collection, Heinz 56, is named after. So this poem is Heinz 56, and it does require a short story, which is that when I was young, I always asked my parents what nationality we were. I said, are we German? Are we Irish? What are we? And my parents' answer was always, well, you're Heinz 56, everything but Italian. And of course, that's ironic because both of my sets of grandparents grew up in Italian sections of the city. Everyone in my family seems to think they're Italian. They cook Italian. But it is apparently the one nationality that I am not. So this is Heinz 56. Seems like I've been cooking gnocchi and manicotti ever since I asked Mom about the family tree. You're Heinz 56, she said, everything but Italian. That time, I picked the most interesting dish to bring to class, cornbread for the Shawnee Indians of the Ohio River Valley. Now, sauce, rich with my parents' homemade Valpolicella, simmers on the stove all afternoon in my steelworker kitchen. Grandma makes the noodles from scratch, and pizzelles are Dad's favorite Christmas treat. They're fitting contradictions. What does the 57 in that ketchup stand for, anyway? The number of ingredients? No. The year of creation? No. It's John Heinz's lucky number, 5, and his wife's auspicious digit, 7. Nothing special. 2 ingredients, 5 and 7, pasta and sauce. When I was living in Florida, I had a wonderful friend who I could always call and rely on when something bad happened, like most of us do. And she always had the right answers. But one time, I think she was a little fed up with all of my trouble. And I told her what was going on, and all I heard was silence for a moment on the phone. And finally, she said, "I have no idea what to tell you. I think you just must have been a horrible person in another life." So I thought, what a great way to start a poem. And of course, if I was in another life, I would have still been in Pittsburgh, right? So I thought, what other people might I have been in Pittsburgh over the years? So this is called Everything and Nothing. When I call my friend to complain about all my misfortunes, she offers a simple solution. You were a dreadful person in another life. It's so matter of fact, but now I'm thinking what I should have told her. It's possible. I might have been Queen Aliquippa, sipping Chinese ginseng and flirting with the general no one knew yet, George Washington. Now today I'm doomed to pay for my feathered eyebrows with eons of men who turn into flesh-eating forest beasts at the sound of the word stay. They're a little soft around the middle, but they have horns and claws beneath the fur. I suppose it could be true that I was the scab, the strike breaker, the first shot at the riot. When Dickens called my city an ugly confusion of backs of buildings and crazy galleries and stairs, I might have spit in his eye and loved Pittsburgh for all the dark places. Perhaps that's why I could never be the skinny, red-headed Italian he wished for on Valentine's Day. And maybe I was John Boyd's unfaithful wife, expecting my husband to kill my lover and save my honor. That could be why still today I can't forget my first love, who calls once a year to remind me of our long-gone anniversary. I was never enough, you will always love me, and all that star-crossed lovers' propaganda. I was the one who lit the match. I was the slumlord of the shanty town, the snake in Franklin's cartoon, the English driving Chief Pontiac into the ground, the fog and smoke that made the city look like night at noon. I was the wealthy, eating off the glass plates that someone chopped his fingers off to make. I was cholera and pitch pots in the street. Everything and nothing. I am the whiskey that burns your throat.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Amanda Reynolds. I'd like to ask you about your use of humor. There's a lot of nice moments of humor in the poems, especially in the hockey poem that you just read about the groundbreaking of the Consol Energy Center. And there was some in the first one that you read, the Pittsburgh Writings of Venice, about try to pronounce all these, you know, Pittsburgh terms without cracking up. But you do sort of move to the heavier stuff, too, like in the Pittsburgh poem. It's a sort of dark humor with, like, we have plenty of room to die. Can you talk about humor and how you work that into your poems?
I can try. I think that mostly I'm just very sarcastic. I think that sarcasm is the thing that works best for me. Also, I am very wary of cliché. If you're going to write a love poem or you're going to write about your family or your memories, there's such a danger in your poem turning into a cliche. So to avoid cliche, I think my fallback is the humor and the sarcasm, and that avoids it being, you know, a little too mushy. So that's probably why I turn to sarcasm often.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, too, about the emphasis on sports in the poem, in the poems. There's a real sort of analysis and like statement about like all the different sort of symbolism of different jerseys and the real details and the culture of sports. And Pittsburgh is such a sports town, but it's not something that I've seen often represented so specifically in poems.
That's true. That's true. I had to include sports in Pittsburgh because, as you said, sports are such a part of this town. But hockey mostly is my first love, and I couldn't write poems without including it somewhere and in my memories of this city. And I'm pretty sure I was the only person living in Tallahassee that had the hockey package on cable to watch all of the Penguins games. I had not missed a hockey game in something like 20 years. So I just couldn't avoid it. But again, I was a little cautious because there are just too many dangers of it becoming, you know, Pittsburgh is a sports town, it's a cliche. And so I tried not to overload the sports, but at the same time, I really wanted to at least get in a little of my memories there. And I know my grandfather talks about, you know, being at Forbes Field, and my mother talked about Mellon Arena, and some of their best memories were sports as well. So I wanted to make sure that was represented in the book.
Okay. Can you read us a few more poems?
Yes, I can. I have wonderful neighbors in my neighborhood of Mount Oliver, actually. And they have given me everything from vegetables from their garden to lawnmowers, in fact, when they saw me move in and I didn't have a lawnmower. And so I did write a few poems once I got to Pittsburgh. And this is one of those poems. It's actually called Vegetable Wars, and it was written based on the neighbors that I have who are constantly bringing me wonderful gifts from their garden. So, Vegetable Wars. I awoke this morning to zucchini carnage flung about the backyard. The dog pranced and swaggered, squash guts oozing from her teeth, biodegradable ravages, spoils of salad, wasted young and delicate, no fritters, no sautéing, no baking, no soup. The neighbor, herbaceous conqueror, had earlier traversed the risky alley to place the vegetable atop my rusty garbage can. And so, I had to offer a similar gesture of peace. What type of gift for this 50-year resident of a shabby fortress? Wine? Chocolate? My gallant canine? No, there must be bread. Pumpkin, walnut, sweet, sweet bread. Kill them with kindness, I must. Put this to an end. But tomatoes kept coming one after the other, and peppers, and onions, and bags of ripe squash. I became a right hermit, avoiding the loot. A few days later, armed with hot pepper mix, I was ready to cross the line again. But in return was fresh salsa, cookies, and homemade pizzelles. So with heavy heart and a full kitchen shelf, I admit defeat. I can't win the vegetable war. So thank God for a Pittsburgh winner. This poem is called If This Is the End. I used to dream of my parents in the front seat of the car, not listening when I told them we were lost, lost beyond directions and lost beyond turning back. Down the concrete boat ramp and into water we'd splash at full speed before I awoke. But this was only a dream after all. Even delusions that happen time after time don't always amount to anything. Grandma digging dirt from Hazelwood and slogging it to Lona Coning, Maryland, year after year to fill in her mother's grave that kept sinking. Once, in the 60s, a young chemistry major from the university drove his 59 Chrysler off the bridge to nowhere, onto the north shore of the Allegheny. Without a scratch, he conquered the unfinished double-deck steel bowstring arch and lived to deny all media requests. The iron workers, ropes optional, climbed the rivets, hand and foot attacking with hellhounds the heads of the old salt-soaked metal. A KDKA cameraman climbs the fish-belly trusses to keep another soul from jumping. Glenn practices the divine trumpet beneath Fort Duquesne Bridge, where the acoustics are the best in the city. In the dream, there were no signs pointing wrong way, stop, turn back. If this is the end, give me a sweet ride, big city blues, and money to pay the one penny toll.
The poetry of Amanda Reynolds. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody 90.5.